began talking about the sin of Adam. And we are on page 14. Now, what was last thing I said last week at the very end of the Thursday was that the Rambam says, the Rambam in the Guide to the Perplexed, the Mor Nebuchim, says that the difference between before the sin and after the sin was that before the sin, man's choice was between truth and falsehood. Or as somebody puts it, Rabbi Gaya Shor puts it, that's Rabbi Shor's father, he says the difference, the choice was between absolute good and absolute evil. After the sin, in other words, it was clear what was absolutely good, it was clear what was absolutely evil. After the sin, the truth is not the choice is not between truth and falsehood, but between good and bad. Now, what does that mean? Between that which is true and that which is good? It's a very big difference. For example, by Yaakov. Yaakov steals the blessing, right? Everybody remember that? Mm-hmm. Right? He comes to his father and he steals the blessing. Is that true? It's not true. Is it good?
Yes,
it's good. So where it's dealing on a level of absolute truth, then that would not be true. When we're dealing on a level of that which is good, then that's good. Because circumstances in this world after the sin are not the same as circumstances before the sin. The circumstances before Adam's sin were such that something which was true was good, and something which was good was true. But now we live in a world which is called Olam HaSheker, the world of falsehood. And the world of falsehood, that which is true is not always good, and that which is good is not always true. Conversely, before the sin, there was falsehood. Falsehood was bad, right? It was clearly false, and that's something which has to be avoided, right? After the sin, falsehood sometimes is, falsehood sometimes is good. Sometimes it's bad, sometimes it's good. For example, we have the case of Moshe Rabbeinu and the Paro. Moshe Rabbeinu consistently, when he speaks to Paro and all these parashiyos, says, we're leaving the time for how many days? 2 days, right? We're not leaving permanently. Obviously, there's some reason why that has to happen. Why? I never really figured it out, but I haven't, for that matter, I haven't thought of it in any great detail. Why Hashem had Moshe Rabbeinu act specifically for a few days? But each time he asked, we want to go sleep a few days to go, sacrifice to God. So that, in that case, was obviously for some reason that falsehood was good, right? Now, in terms of, let's look at it the other way around, right? The other way around is that the thing beforehand, again, things which were sheker were things which were true were good, and things which were false were bad. So now we have to look for something where we have something which we would perceive to be true, and yet is nevertheless bad. So what is an example of something which is true yet nevertheless bad? What's an example?
Anti-Semitism.
What?
Anti-Semitism.
Okay. I was talking more about specifics of Jewish sins as opposed to, that kind of stuff. Something which is true and is bad, a good example of that would be, for example, Lashon Hara. Now, Lashon Hara is absolutely true. And in a world which is completely based on truth, it may well be that Lashon Hara should be permitted, because everybody should know the truth about everybody else. But after the world is not on the level where it's supposed to be, so obviously for me, go to tell even the truth about you. Not necessarily a good thing, right? Now, it's more than that. That's at a superficial level, the world that what we just said is that the circumstances changed in the world from before and afterwards, before and after the absolute truth. And there's a fascinating Gemara in Sanhedrin, very, very fascinating Gemara. The Gemara says there was a certain town where the was named Luz. And we imagine this Gemara is metaphorical, at least to some extent. But Gemara says that there was a certain town which had the name Luz. And in the town of Luz, nobody ever died. Why they never die? Because everybody was told absolute truth all the time. If they wanted to die, eventually they get sick of living, I guess. If they wanted to die, they have to leave the city in order to die. So then there was a certain Amora, one of the sages of the Talmud, who came to the city, and he took up residence there, and he married a woman in the city and had kids. So one day, he was living in the city, the neighbor from next door came to visit his wife. And his wife was, at that time, in the shower, or whatever she was bathing. And he said, you know, it's not nice to say that she's bathing. I'll tell her that, you know, which you're allowed to do. I'll tell her that she's sleeping, otherwise unavailable. How logically you're allowed to do that? His two kids died. So that's what happened. Nobody ever dies in the city. How did these two kids die? So they came to the Samora and said, what happened? They said, well, this is what happened. So they say, you know what, you have to leave. Can you please leave now? Because this is not the way we live in this city. Now, obviously, that level of truth is something which is not from this world. Because in this world, there's death. That was a level of the world before sin, when Adam could have been immortal, and the world of after the resurrection. And that's why the name of the city is what? Luz. What else is named Luz? Special credit. The bone from which Kriyat HaMe can take place. The bone from which the resurrection grows, so to speak, is the Luz bone. The Luz bone is fed by, what's the name of the Luz bone? Rava Malka. Rava Malka, after Shabbos is over, that's what sustains the Luz bone. Why that sustains the Luz bone? Not for now. But the point is that element of truth, which is within an individual, that element of truth is what gives him eternity, gives him the resurrection, which is eternal, and that's the link to Adam before the sin and to after the and the state of after the resurrection. But in this world, it's not possible. That Amora, I forget his name is Meshul Amora, that Amora who told a white lie did the right thing, a good thing, by this world's concept, but not a good thing by the concept of truth and falsehood. Okay, so that's one aspect, that in inherent in individuals now is the capacity, or rather the imperative, I should say, not to be always truthful, right? But again, as I said, it goes deeper than that. On the act before the sin, everybody agrees that evil was something distinct from man. And we said yes, distinct from man.
Separate from man. Okay.
Yeah.
Evil man.
Evil man was separate. In other words, we had said yes last week that there's a disagreement whether the snake was an angelic creature, you know, like the incarnation of the Satan, of the evil inclination, or the snake was, you know, a quasi person. We had a lot of difficulty with that approach, but we saw in the Talmud that there was an approach that the snake was almost a human being, certainly very high up there in terms of his functioning. So then he wasn't evil incarnate, but he was also something which had free will or free choice. So according to whichever approach it is, prior to the sin, man did not have the evil inclination within them. I really don't like the evil inclination. I really don't like that term, the evil inclination. It's a bad term, which really should be the bad inclination. Because Yetzer Hara means that which is causing a person to go towards bad things. Evil, I don't know if there's a word in Hebrew exactly for evil. Ra means bad. Ra means bad. I'm trying to think if there's a word evil for evil. A Rasha is a person who is a bad person. I don't know. I have to think about it. But certainly when it's used in terms of human being, it's not evil in that sense. And it's bad. It's dangerous. It causes a person potentially to do bad things. But it's not in of itself evil. Otherwise, Chazal, the rabbis would not say, when we say the Chol Levavcha in Shema, with all your heart, right, plural, it says the Chol Levavcha means both your heart. They say with both of your heart, both your good inclination and your bad inclination. So obviously there's something in the negative inclination which is positive, which can be used for good reason, for good purpose. But in any event, prior to the sin that was outside, it was outside of the human being. After the sin, and what we'll have to discuss, we haven't gone to yet, is this is a very lumdish thing. It's a very interesting Talmudic question, which is what caused evil to enter a person? I'll use the term evil. What caused evil to enter a person? Was it the fruit itself which he ate, or was it the act of sinning which brought it into him? Understand? Mm-hmm. The fruit is because the Eitz HaDaat tov hara. Was it quality in the fruit? Or was it the fact that he ate of the fruit he was told not to that caused it to happen? It's not clear. Could be either or. But whichever way it was, after the sin, a person has an internal inclination to do bad things. And the way Rabbi Gedalia Shor puts it very beautifully, Julia Tan Nifta Milyo is bringing from. I mentioned this once before, but I don't think any of you were here at the time. But the Rabbi Deckler says, when I sin, let's say I want ice cream, right? I say, I want ice cream, right? I'm telling myself, I want ice cream. Now, something tells me, well, ice cream's bad for you. So then it says to me, you shouldn't have the ice cream. But that's also an internal voice. When I talk about what I want, it's I. When I talk to myself about restraint, it's you. Even in my inner perspective. And according to Freud, I am my id, and the superego is what restrains my id. I don't know how many Freudians we have here. But the ego restrains my id, sorry. You see, ego is what brings me the strength, and the superego is that correlates the two. Whatever. So the point is that a person before the sin, says the Milchem Leo, if you ask Adam what he was, what he wanted as the I, first person, he would say, I want to serve God. And then the snake came to him and said, you shouldn't serve God. Second, he was the first person, serve God. Second person said, don't serve God. Now, after the sin, the opposite is true. The I, meaning my physical soul person, which is lived in the physical world, wants all sorts of stuff. Permitted stuff, forbidden stuff, and then I have to impose upon myself restraint. And that imposition is the second person. I want ice cream. No, you shouldn't have ice cream. Is that clear? Mm. Okay, so that drive, which we associate with ourselves, was something which was foreign to an individual before the sin of Adam. Again, the snake had to come from the outside and convince Chava that this was something which she should have. Because the internal inclination was, you don't do these things. God said not to. This is not me. But he caused it to become her that now she wants the fruit. And she has to restrain herself and she's not able to do so. Now, there are a couple of other things along these lines. First of all, before the sin, this is the same idea but going a little bit deeper. Before the sin, there was either absolute good or absolute bad. What God said was absolute good, and what the serpent said was absolute bad, right? And man had the capacity to function on a level where things he did were absolutely good. After the sin, it is almost impossible to do a deed in which there isn't some sort of self-interest, vested interest that I'm doing it for, such as for reward, for honor, right? For Olam Haba, for the world to come. All those things are personal interests, which are not proper motivations for one's deeds. Ideally speaking, they should be eliminated. But it's very hard to eliminate. That's because within an individual at this point in time, we have a tarobet, a mixture of good and bad. The other thing is true as well. If we sin, we don't usually feel so good about it, right? And in fact, sometimes when we sin, we also make a cheshbon, we have a reason why there's really a good thing to do. We very rarely rebel against God, you know, in an open act of brazen rebellion. So there's two things, so everything is no longer black and white, but rather everything is on gray shades, you know, 256, I think, shades of gray that the computer has. So you have everything is in the gray scale, somewhere along that continuum. In fact, the Rambam says, at the end of Malchus, the Rambam says, in order to get to the world to come, you have to do at least one mitzvah in your life completely lishma, completely for selfless reasons, out of your love of God, in order to sanctify God's name, out of your awe of God, not because you want to achieve the world to come, not because you're going to get honor, not because you're going to get paid, but completely selflessly for God. So at that point, says the Rambam, that's why we have a lot of mitzvahs. Because It's very hard to do one mitzvah for the sake of heaven the right way. So God gives us a lot of opportunities. Maybe in the course of our lifetime, we'll get to do one mitzvah for the right reason. Maybe that'll get us into the world to come. Other than that, we don't have a chance. It's a very depressing Rambam, but that's what the Rambam says. That also is a manifestation of the sin. And that's what the tree was called, the Eitz Hadaat Tovara. The tree of knowledge of good and bad, meaning everything now is mixed good and bad together. There's no longer the clarity of truth versus falsehood. Because that which is true is not always good, and that which is false is not always bad. And everything is now mixed together in one big hodgepodge, and everything we do has all sorts of myriad aspects to it, some good, some bad, some indifferent, and that all comes from the sin of man. Okay? Now, this is an important point to make, which is, even after the sin of man, we're not going to see another sin until Cain. I mentioned this last week. Until Cain kills Abel, right? At that point, there's a fascinating part that I really was going to leave it, but we got there, but let's look at it now, because I want to then refer to it. There's a part, the pasuk is on page 20, 21. It's the pasuk Zion, verse 7. It's an amazing pasuk. But Hashem says to Cain, "Halo in tetiv se'eis, surely if you improve yourself, you will be forgiven. V'imlo tetiv, but if you do not improve yourself, la'petach chatos ro'eis, sin rests at the door. Its desire is toward you. Yet you can conquer it." It's an amazing process. I know people go for that course. You know, people learn go for gracious very quickly because it's right after some class later. Everybody's still drunk, whatever. So nobody drinks some class later. But the idea is, of course, it's an amazing verse because Hashem actually, I think, is the only place in the Torah where Hashem comes to man and says, "Listen, personal growth is very important. You have to constantly be better and better and better because this thing, sin, is waiting at the door." So Hashem said sin is not just something which you do, but rather sin is an entity in and of itself. Okay, so this is a fascinating pasuk, which really we need to see, again, I'm a little jumping ahead, in order to understand what is happening after Adam's sin, how the world has changed, and how there is this constant enticement of sin, and how, as a result, one has to constantly improve in order to grow, in order to avert it. So we'll have to do, I said I was jumping the gun, so let's go back, and then we'll come back to this later on, maybe tomorrow. So in the meantime, let's go a little bit further here, on page 14. And last week we got on page 14, up to where it says, in the second verse, after the Nachash spoke to her, it says, "Vayomer Yishar Nachash, the woman said to the serpent, Mipri Eitz Hagan Ochel, of the fruit of any tree of the garden, we may eat." Next verse, "Umipri Eitz Asher B'Soch Hagan, of the fruit of the tree which is in the center of the garden, Amar Elohim, God has said, Lo sochu mimenu, you shall neither eat of it, the lo tizu bo, and do not touch it, lest you die." Now, see the article on page 15, 3, 4? Lo tizu bo, nor touch it. God had commanded them not only not to eat, but Eve had added to the prohibition. The outcome of doing so was to diminish the commandment. The serpent pushed her against the tree and said, "Just as you did not die from touching it, so you will not die from eating it." You see that? So the other serpent doesn't learn like that. That's a medrash. Rashi brings it down. But the other serpent doesn't say something different. The other serpent doesn't say that when the other serpent was the source of the Talmud we saw last week, which talked about the snake, you know, that he was quite a human creature. So the other serpent doesn't say that it was Adam's fault that she sinned, because when rabbis make a decree, they have to clarify what part of the law is Torah law, and what part is the decree which they're adding onto it. And in fact, Adam said to Chava, Adam said to Chava, we're not allowed to touch the tree. But he didn't say, I'm the one who's forbidding you to touch the tree. He just said, we're not allowed to touch it. And that was a big mistake. Because now, Chava perceived, she didn't get the command directly from God, according to other seven of them. She got the command from Adam, who told it to her. So when he told it to her, she thought the command from God was comprised of both aspects. Both the aspect not to touch it, both the aspect not to eat it, and the aspect not to touch it. She was misinformed. And she said she was misinformed when she touched it. She said, well, if the God is not all-powerful on this, so why should be all-powerful on that? I mean, if I didn't touch it and I didn't die, what? Who says I'm going to die when I eat it? Right? Is that clear? So therefore, Adam is actually faulted for not having clarified what was his addition, what was his rabbinic enactment, so to speak, to the original Torah law. Okay? Which is a very important idea. Why is that a very important idea? Because it hooks into what we said before about truth and falsehood. If something is not absolutely true, certainly before the sin, so it was not absolutely true. Adam, in essence, it wasn't a lie. It wasn't completely true what he said. Right? He said, God, don't, it was a command, don't touch it. Right? So he was commanding not to touch it. That was not true. There's not, he gave left the misimpression that God commanded it. Right? That misimpression, that falsehood, was already the kernel, the potential sin was all in that slight deviation, not being fully not getting full disclosure about the nature of what God commanded versus what he commanded. Yeah. Okay. So the Nachash seizes this opportunity, right? Like Rashi says. So that's what God said. Now I imagine that the Nachash, the snake, heard Adam say what he said, and this was all part of his plan to begin with, right? So after he said, that's what God said, let's go touch the tree and let's see what happens when he touched the tree. So she touches the tree. Nothing happens when she touches the tree, right? That's what Rashi says here, according to the Medrash. So what happens in the next pasuk? So it said, Hayonah Nochash al Isha lo mos tumusum. So for, I think this is all, this before she touches it. First he says, the snake says to her, you're not going to die. Don't worry, right? It says here, the way the article translates is very funny. You will not surely die. It sounds like he's saying, you know, you might die, but not for sure. Mm-hmm. Right? I don't think that's actually what it means to say. It means you're not going to die. Okay? Because I don't think that that's an accurate translation. So in any event, so he says, Kiyodea Elohim. For God knows, Kibion Apochem Imenu, that on the day that you eat of it, your eyes will be open, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil. Now, a fascinating thing which I did not point out yet, which I'm going to point out now, is that in Pasuk, in fourth line from the top, right, is the last time we saw, fourth line from the beginning of verse 22, it's the last time it says God's full name. The Yud, the He, the Vav, and the He. Where's the next time we see the Yud, Yud-Ke, Vav-Ke? On the next page. What? Oh, right. I'm saying, you're right. Here it says, I'm sorry. I might apologize. The last one, what is this?
Just left the Gimel, the one below the Gimel is in the middle.
Oh. Yeah, I'm sorry. As the first book here, before the dialogue, I'm sorry, you're right, it's there, it's supposed to be, before the dialogue between the snake and the woman, you have Hashem, Yud-Kei Vav-Kei, at the end of the first verse. It doesn't appear again till the eighth pasuk, till after they sin, Hashem Elohim. The whole dialogue between the snake and Chava is all about to be like Elohim. Right? But he doesn't try and tell you to be like Hashem. He doesn't say to be like Hashem, he just says like Elohim. You see that? Mm-hmm. The command was by Elohim, he says to the snake. The snake says to her, not Hashem Elohim, right? And Chava says, the Chabad says that's him, the Elohim, right? The Pleiter Eitzes Ozan Amar Elohim Rosof Lemenu. And then the Choshev, the Yisem Ke Elohim, you're going to be like Elohim, and God told you not to do it to obey Elohim because he knows that you're going to be like Elohim. Where is the Hashem gone? Why is this all taking place on the level of Elohim? Well, what's the difference between Elohim and Hashem?
Justice versus...
Justice versus mercy, but there's a deeper difference which underlies that, which is that Elohim is not, means, the way we say it, is master of forces. And God is, Hashem, just for shorthand purpose, means he's everything. I don't mean he's everything, but anything you could say about God is included in the Yud Kei Vav Kei, much more than Elohim, right? Why is that? Because Yud Kei Vav Kei is the name which represents the deepest, most profound relationship which God has with the world, which is that he was, he is, he will be, and he sustains everything. But master forces at much lower level. And that's why we find a Chumash a few times that the word Elohim is used to describe human beings who are judges, right? Judges are called in Parshas Mishpatim Elohim. And we find that also other gods are called Elohim as well. Elohim Achirim, right? We never find that other gods are called Yudke Boke Achirim, right? The explicit name Achirim is no such thing. But Elohim, which means the master of forces, there are other gods, which may be masters of forces. You know, it could be that idolatry has nothing to it. And maybe, you know, well, there are all sorts of things one can accomplish through Elohim Achirim. But there's only one Yudke Boke. That's only one of those. But now, it's not much in Chava can't talk, and they don't bother talking about the level of Yudke Boke. Because that's silly. God is not physical. Chava is physical. She's not going to be Yudke Boke, right? She can't be that. But she can be an Elohim. All of them can be an Elohim. What is Elohim? And in fact, we know that man is still an Elohim. He is the reflection of God, right? So what does it mean a man who can be an Elohim? So what Adam is saying, what the Nachash is saying to Chava is, look it, once God made the world, which is in the last chapter, now who controls the world is up for grabs. He made it, he's of course a supreme entity, but he made a world which is physical and has its own rules. So now it's up for grabs who's actually going to be in charge. Who's going to be the master of forces? Is it him or is it me and you and Adam? And we have the same thing also at the end of Parshas Noah, where they build, let's take a look at this. Where they build the Tower of Babel. That's on page 48. It says, I'm just going to read the English. The whole earth was of one language and of common purpose, came to pass, and they migrated from the east. They found the plain of land of Shinar and settled there. They said to one another, come, let us make bricks and burn them in the fire. And the bricks served them as stone, and the lime served them as mortar. And they said, come, let us build a city and a tower with its top in the heavens, and let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be dispersed across the whole earth. A very strange desire, right? Then it says, of course, Hashem descended, and of course it says Hashem with the Yurkei Bokei in the next few psukim. But what do they want to do? Are they insane? They think they can fight God? They think they can be an alternative to God? They're crazy, right? No, the answer is yes. They could be an alternative to God. Not only that, you'll see it's an amazing thing. I just noticed that this past year, that when God comes down, look at the next few psukim. It says, Hashem descends, look at the city and the tower with sons of man built. And Hashem said, behold, they are one people, one language for all. And this they begin to do, and now should it not be withheld from them all their purpose they propose to? Come, let us descend, and there confuse their language, that they should not understand one another's language. Now, the translation is not a literal translation. It's article manipulated translation. The literal translation of the Hebrew is, now, they're one nation, one language, and this is what they began to do. Nothing will be beyond their accomplishment. So therefore, nothing is beyond their capacity to accomplish. Let's go and mix up their language. Very strange thing, right? What's that? It's almost as God is afraid, right? We really can't say that, but that's what it sounds like. It says, God says, we got to cut this off. We got to stop it in its tracks, right? Why? Because who knows what's going to happen if they succeed? What do you mean if they succeed? How are they going to succeed? How stupidity is that? How's the show? How are they going to succeed? But what's happening here is that the same idea. What do they say? They say, not to the one who's shamed. Let's make ourselves a name. What do we make ourselves a name? If you make yourself a name, you can fight against God. That makes you something, right? You made yourself a name. There are many people who have names. Well, everybody has a name, right? Countries have names. Places have names. And by faith building has a name. It's very tall also. But it doesn't represent something which can oppose God and oppose to fight with the heavens. So the idea here is the shame means we want to make ourselves a divine name. God has a divine name, Elohim. We want that name. Their powers, their vast powers, to be, so to speak, scooped up. And it's interesting because God doesn't want to let them get that far because God did make certain rules in creation. And if they get far enough, there's a lot of power to be scooped up. There's a lot of mastery of forces which they can actually acquire. Now, of course, in the Obama analysis, God is God, and, you know, he could actually zap them all if he wants to, right? But he doesn't actually do that, except in the final result, final analysis, if all else fails, and like he did by storm, of course, and they thought that he doesn't even do it in the last resort. Because once he created the world, he's, so to speak, bound by the rules which he made. The same is true about Amalek. Amalek is an amazing concept. Amalek comes, this week's parasha, B'Shalos. At the end of B'Shalos, let's look at it. Page 390. Amalek came and battled Israel and defeated him, the last line. Moses said to Joshua, choose people, etc. And then at the end it says, and skipping to the end, it says, for the hand is on the throne of God, Hashem maintains the war against Amalek from generation to generation. That's interesting. God maintains the war against Amalek. Let them stop all the Amalek. That's what it says. You know? Why didn't he get all of them? Eradicate them. Annihilate them, right? For that matter, what is Amalek insane? I'm going to do Rashi brings it down. I don't think here, but if the Rashi thing brings it in Devarim. It says that Amalek, they just saw the red, they just saw the 10 plagues in Egypt, they just saw the Red Sea being split, they saw all the Egyptians annihilated, and here they come and attack the Jews. What are they, suicidal? It doesn't make any sense. Excuse me? So the splitting of the sea is the suicidal. The splitting of the sea is the next week's parasha, before this episode with Amalek. So what the idea is, the same idea as Migdal Babel, the same idea as the Nachash's conversation with Chava. The Nachash's conversation with Chava is, you can be the Elohim, right? You can be the master of forces. Migdal Babel is, you can be the master of forces. Amalek also says, we can be the master of forces. And that's why the Kabbalists say, the Bar Mashava say, Amalek is the Seder, they believe in the Seder of Mikra. It says later on in Dvarim, Asher Korcho Baderach, they happened. They chanced upon you in the desert, right? So it says on page, let's take a look. I don't think it's Rashi. I think it's Rashi in Dvarim. It's Rashi on page 1066. And the article on page 1067. It says there on the article on page 1067,
He happened upon you on the way.
He happened upon you upon the way. Where's that? The first one, the second one. Right. and he happened upon you upon the way. So what does it mean, he happened upon you upon the way? Literally means, you know, literally means they didn't actually plan the attack. It was like a spontaneous thing. They came, they were walking across the desert, and the Jews were walking here, right? And they said, oh, the Jews, that's attack, right? That's your father, that's happened upon the Jews, so they started attacking. But, in a sense, right? So now what it says in Shmos, Shmos seems like it was an intentional planned war. So the again, where they say that Amalek is believed in chances. This is a very interesting idea. Chances means that once God created the world, he stepped aside and said, okay, now let everybody take their chances. Everything's up for grabs, right? If you want to try and be an Elohim, you can be an Elohim. I just chose the Jews, is what Amalek thinks. I just chose the Jews, but hey, everything is subject to chances, right? There's a chance that they're going to lose it and we'll take over. That's why, of course, Haman is the one who makes a lottery. The lottery is ultimately a game of chance, right? That's what he says. You know, I'll find it. It's an amazing thing, Purim. Because Haman, again, everybody seems to be insane in all these episodes, right? Haman thinks by spinning whatever, I don't know if it's a roulette wheel or casting the dice, whatever he did, pulled the paper out of the hat, he thinks he's going to find a day, which is a great day for attacking the Jews. What kind of idiot is he, right? The Jews are going to be safe on any day. They'll be safe on any day. If they're not safe, they'll be still unsafe on any day. No. So Haman is also of the same idea. They are great spiritual powers to be had. And Haman says, how do you get the powers? By chance. What does by chance mean? By being able to find the right opening to get in there and take the powers at random almost, without any merit, and take them to yourself. And when we get closer to the Purim, we'll speak about that a little bit more, because there's a lot of things in the beginning which have to do with that. So the idea is that there's a capacity for somebody to insert themselves or between the Jews and Hashem, and undermine their special relationship. And here, at the beginning of the Torah, the Nachah says to Chava, it all begins here. It says, the Nachah says to Chava, you know what? You can be Elohim. You can be like Elohim. And the truth is, he wasn't wrong. Again, here, after man sins, what does Hashem do? Say, what should we do very quickly?
Kick him out,
right? Because if we don't kick them out, they're going to eat from the other tree, right? So just kill the other tree, you know? You've got to chop it down with an axe, you know? Whatever it is, it makes to you, so there won't be a tree of life. There's things going on here. There's a reality that there are great powers which are possible for a person to get a hold of. Not us, we're just morons. But people who are great, who are functioning at that level, that was a different level of achievement. And, one second, just one more thing, and it's not a coincidence, we'll come back to tomorrow when we go further. The rabbis say the first allusion to Haman in the Torah. Where's the first allusion to Haman? On page 16. 16, 1-6. Right? As Michal just said, it says in the 11th verse, Paskirav, it says, and he said, who told you are naked? Have you eaten from the tree from which I command you not to eat? And then in Hebrew says, Hamin ha'etz asher tivisicho lebetzio achom imen al-chalta. Hamin, says the Gemara, is Haman. That's allusion to Haman in the Torah. Which think, of course, there must be a reason why the rabbis decided they have to find this allusion here. And they find it here in the context of this tree. Okay, we'll stop here for today. Who had a question?
Could you say that, you know, in today's world, you know, we're learning